records were set and milestones achieved.
Last night's Oscar ceremony could largely be described as inert, but for a few standout moments, as when the best foreign language film was announced.
A Separation, Iran, Oscar Farhadi.
The first Iranian movie to win an Oscar and the second to be nominated is a quietly devastating, stereotype-shattering portrait of a family and a society in crisis. In his acceptance speech, director Oscar Farhadi referred to recent talk of war and aggression before dedicating his Oscar to the people of Iran.
Who respect all cultures and civilizations and despise hostility and resentment. Thank you so much.
While the official Iranian news media trumpeted the win as a victory over Israel, backstage Farhadi told reporters he hoped the prism of culture could help people around the world see each other more clearly. Neda Ulubi, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Illinois public media stations celebrate 90 years of public service broadcasting. To kick off a year of memories and celebrations, NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook will visit the WILL studios. Join Andrea Seabrook and the WILL news team for a wine and cheese reception on Wednesday, April 11. Tickets are $25 a person. Reservations can be made by calling 217-333-7300.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting American Spirit on Saturday, March 10th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Sinfonia celebrates the originality and innovation of American composers from Gillis to Gershwin. Jim Pugh, Jonathan Keeble, and Dmitry Kutsov are featured. More information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show, hour two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Dearborn, Michigan is home to Fordson High School. And the students at Fordson have concerns, just like high school kids all across the country. And like their peers across the country, they play football. But these students face a special challenge as they prepare for a big game against their crosstown rivals. The students at Fordson are Muslim, and this game is taking place during Ramadan. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking with Asha Qureshi. He is the producer of an award-winning documentary, Fordson Faith Fasting Football, about a mostly Muslim football team in Dearborn, Michigan. It's a very good film and says a lot about the experiences of Muslims in America, particularly after 9/11. It's a documentary that will be screened tonight in Champaign at the Art Theater. This is in downtown Champaign at 7 o'clock. It is free, so folks should certainly take the opportunity to see the movie. And Ashar will be introducing the film, and then we'll take questions afterwards. So that's something that you might well want to take in. If you want to find out more about the movie, by the way, there is a website, FordsonTheMovie.com, which is the website. You can find out more about it. Just a little bit more about our guest. Asha Qureshi is an Emmy Award-winning television journalist, writer, photographer, filmmaker. He works for WTTW, that is the public television station in Chicago, where he reports for their flagship nightly news magazine, Chicago Tonight. His reporting and photography has also been featured on CNN, New York Times, PBS NewsHour, A&E, and the Oprah Winfrey Show. And we're very pleased that he's here in studio with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe I also should give the telephone number. Folks want to call in, ask questions, make comments, whatever's on your mind. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And there's also the possibility of email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So tell me, talk a little bit about the genesis of this film and how it came about.
Well, it was sort of a perfect storm, if you will. My wife and I, who had worked together for a long time at CNN, we were there for about 6.5-7 years almost, and we'd both been in the long form unit before being shipped overseas to Islamabad immediately following 9/11 to open the bureau there. And my wife mostly had been in the documentary unit, which eventually became CNN Presents, their long-form production unit. And, you know, part of it was a promise to her that, you know, after doing 3 years of running and gunning all over Pakistan, that we would do something closer to her roots, which was long-form and documentary. Mm-hmm. And it was basically the idea was came from my brother-in-law, who was a marketing executive, a sports marketing executive based in Chicago. And what he does is, you know, he's produced live telecasts of high school games. He creates events that are sponsored by, you know, various companies. And, you know, he'll, for example, he'll bring together the best high school basketball team in Chicago and face off with the best high school basketball team in New York. And a friend of his, Chris Lawler, who worked for USA Today back in probably 03, 04, wrote an article about this team. And my brother-in-law, Rashid Ghazi, loved the story and thought this would make a great live telecast event to follow this football team and to show what happens on the field as they're fasting. The problem was that the Michigan State rules don't allow for the live telecast of high school games. So he thought of, well, what's the next step? Maybe a documentary. And so he approached us years ago, and we had talked about possibly collaborating on a documentary with him. And you know, it took years and years to convince, you know, not only the principal and the coach, but also the school district to allow us in, because they have such strict rules about, you know, the way that teams and games are portrayed on television and in film. So it took a lot of convincing, and it actually took, you know, about 6 years before we got everybody to agree to do it. And even, you know, just weeks before we were supposed to start shooting in 2009, which was the last time we could do it because the holy month of Ramadan falls within the football season. You know, it fell at least until 2009, but was moving 10 days each year because it's on a lunar calendar. Mm-hmm. It would be the last opportunity for 20 years for us to do this story. And so he said to us, he said, you know what? I don't want to do this when I'm 60. We've got to push through and somehow convince them. And he made a last ditch effort and, you know, talked to the board and convinced them. And, you know, my wife, Basma, who co-produced the film with me, had 2 weeks to put the production together. And the two of us, you know, pretty much scouted it out and got out there and shot for the first 11 days in 09. And it was a really interesting time to shoot as well, because the last 10 days of Ramadan in 2009 happened to begin on September 11th. So it was a, you know, sort of an interesting time. It was the last 10 days of Ramadan. It was the last time it was going to be in football season. And it also happened to kick off with the way that they commemorated 9/11 in the school, as you see in the film.
Yeah, and so what happens in the movie is you go into the homes of students, you talk with the football players, talk about themselves, their aspirations, their family life. We get to meet, in some cases, we get to meet their parents. We see their home life, but we also go into the classroom, and we also go on the field with them as they train, and we're in the room there when the coach is giving his pump up speech to before the guys go out, and we see them on the field. So I think you really did a pretty good job of getting at all these different aspects of the lives of the players.
It's funny, when we brought the material to our writer, Ruth Lightman, who is an amazing documentary producer in her own right, she said, you have enough material for 5 documentaries here. We shot about 70 hours of material, and we had to whittle it down to about 90 minutes. And that's, you know, it's just incredibly difficult to do because there was so much rich material. We had unprecedented access. And so, you know, it took a lot of time for us to all agree on what parts would stay and what parts wouldn't stay. And I think that was the most challenging part, because there was so much that we had to get across, so many issues to explore, that it made it a little bit difficult in terms of paring it down. But as you mentioned, we jam-packed it with as much as we could to explore as many of these aspects, these interesting aspects, and this interesting diaspora of what's going on in Dearborn, Michigan today and how it relates to what's going on in the country today.
Yeah, and I guess maybe we should make the point that Dearborn, Michigan is the, let me see if I get this right, outside of the Middle East, this community has the greatest concentration, say by percentage of population,
yes, yes,
of Arabs,
outside the Middle East. It is the highest concentration of Middle Easterners, mm-hmm. and we explore a little bit of how that happened, mm-hmm. this phenomenon of why there are so many Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in Dearborn, Michigan, and a lot of it relates to obviously what was going on with the auto industry boom, and it just so happened that, you know, 100 years ago when Arabs started coming to the United States, you know, they went where the jobs were, and that's where the jobs were, in the Detroit area. And they would call their brothers and their sisters and their cousins. And so it was a natural place for them to go. And the story really is about the immigrant experience. The twist is that 9/11 changed this immigrant experience for this particular community. The closest thing you could possibly relate it to, which you know we touch on in the film, is what happened with Japanese Americans. Now, this is not nearly to the extent of how they were treated in the United States, but it is something similar, and it's the one thing that they can relate to in terms of their experiences as people who are third and fourth generation here, but still are seen as outsiders, despite how hard they try.
Yeah, it's sad in a way. I think that you would have to make a film to make that point, mm-hmm. but it certainly the film does, I think, make a very strong point that these folks are family means everything to them. Their culture means a great deal to them. Their faith means a great deal to them, and the American dream means a great deal to them. And in that respect, I think the film tries to make this point and says, you know, in that respect, they're no different than just about any other American.
Exactly. And you know, that was what was so fascinating to us, you know, was we expected them to feel sorry for themselves to a certain extent, but they refused to take that posture. They're very positive. They're very much, don't feel sorry for me. We acknowledge the opportunities that we have in the United States. We acknowledge the opportunities that we didn't have back home, which is why we came here, which is why our fathers came here and our grandfathers came here. And despite the challenges that they faced, you know, in the wake of post 9/11 America, they still are grateful for having the opportunity to have the freedoms that they have in the United States. And so they are extremely proud. And I don't know if you noticed this, but I noticed it after I saw the film a couple of times, but there are flags flying everywhere. They are very patriotic. And so to cast suspicion or doubt on their commitment to being Americans is, I think, the thing that they feel the most hurt by. And they have the same dreams and aspirations as all Americans and all immigrants who come to the United States as well.
Yeah, let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for anybody who might just have tuned in. Ashar Qureshi is an Emmy Award-winning television journalist, writer, photographer, filmmaker, was at one point the CNN Pakistan Bureau Chief. He is the co-producer of the documentary Fordson, Faith, Fasting, Football, that is set at this high school in Dearborn, Michigan, Fordson High, and in part tells the story of the football team and the fact that they play a big game at the point of the year where people are observing Ramadan. And we'll talk, for people who don't know why that's an issue, we'll talk about that in a second. And I do also want to mention again that you will have the opportunity, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'll have an opportunity to see the movie that will be shown at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign just one time tonight at 7, and it's free. So you should take the opportunity to see the movie. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So this, perhaps some people will not know, that during Ramadan, Muslims fast during the daytime. And that means not only can they not eat, they cannot drink. They can't even drink water.
That's
and
right.
This, for Muslim athletes, mm-hmm. people who are in training, this is a big issue for all kinds of athletes. This is a big issue.
Absolutely. And it's something we explore in the film. And when you see it through the eyes of teenagers, they really sort of boil it down and put it in perspective. And the basis is this, is during the month of Ramadan, Muslims refrain from eating food or drink from sunrise to sunset. It's considered the holiest time for them. They engage in a lot of prayer, extra prayer, family time, but they also fast. And that means no water, no food from sunrise to sunset. And it just so happens that practice happens to be at 3:00 in the afternoon. So these kids are going through the whole day. They get through their classes, and then they hit the field in late summer, early fall, when it is very hot out there on turf, which makes it even hotter.
And they're wearing their pads.
They're wearing everything. And they are doing two-a-days, and they can't have any water. And so it was really interesting to see the perspective from, you know, we hear kids complain about all kinds of things. And you can't help but be inspired by kids who would deal with those kinds of issues and those kinds of things and not complain about it and just trudge forward and focus on winning. It really puts in perspective the things we complain about, and you think, wow, you know, I mean, and the whole idea behind fasting for them is to really get a sense of what it's like for people who don't have food, and it's to experience hunger and thirst, and to give charity as a result of that sympathy and that understanding that's gained through the process of fasting. I mean, and as you mentioned, a lot of people think of fasting as, oh, you can't eat. No, you can't eat or drink. And for most people, the eating is an issue, but the drinking is really tough to deal with. I mean, imagine going all day long without drinking, and then add to that practice in pads on turf, and you can't even possibly imagine it. And so, I mean, just watching these kids, it just blew my mind, but they dealt with it. And I think that was something that was really admirable. And even the classmates and the students and the players that weren't Muslim, for example, because the team is about 98% Muslim the year we shot. And there were other players who didn't practice, didn't observe the fast, but they completely were in tune with what their co-teammates were going through. Some of them would fast even just to get a sense of what their teammates were going through. There's a coach in the film, non-Muslim coach, who fasted because he said, look, I got to know how hard to push these kids. Yeah. And so to understand, he said, well, if I'm fasting and I can see that it's really hot right now and I'm having trouble standing here, I know how hard to push these kids. And safety is a huge issue. And that's something that the head coach was at the forefront of talking about, was how do you manage and balance these kids' faith with this, this requirement to practice during the days without food or water.
And that's something that I think if I'm a coach, I'm going to be really concerned about, because more and more, I think in recent years, and rightly so, there have been concerns raised about whether coaches are they really paying enough attention to the health and welfare of their players and what they put them through. So here, I've got to be really concerned that these guys have gone all day, they haven't eaten, they can't drink, they're out there sweating, it's hot, you know, and I'm responsible for their health. So if some guy drops over from heat prostration, you know, they're going to come looking for me and
exactly.
Say, you know, why did you let this happen?
Right. And I think it's changed over the last few years. I mean, the year after we shot, the coach Zaban decided to move practices to overnight, which was a huge controversy. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a few students who obviously were non-Muslim, and so he had to deal with the issue with talking to those parents and saying, well, you know, for the greater good, because I can't tell these kids not to observe, you know, their faith, their requirements as Muslims. So how can I make this safer? And so they moved practices for those last couple of days to overnights. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about that. But it was, in essence, for the safety of these kids. And but we caught them that last year that they were doing it during the day. And it was just fascinating to see them work through that.
Yeah. So so now, though, this it's not going to happen again for another 20 years, so they don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting as I was watching the movie, because I think it really it makes a lot of very strong points. Mm-hmm. But it's also a football movie. We talked just before we got going about how you're looking for places that it might be broadcast. Mm-hmm. And one of the places you said you were talking about was ESPN. Well, I could actually see ESPN running this, because it very much is in it strikes a lot of familiar notes if you've ever watched a movie about sports.
Absolutely. It's got a Remember the Titans kind of feel for it. Yeah. And I think 20 years from now, we may see this as a feature film, because it does have that underdog feel to it. I mean, these are kids who, you know, through no fault of their own, are dealing with huge issues that had nothing to do with them. I mean, the events of 9/11 happened in New York, were perpetrated by terrorists who claimed to be of the same religion of them. And so they're dealing with that on the field, a little bit of the racism and then the stigma, and all of those things piling in together make for a great underdog story. And so, you know, from that standpoint, it's a great football movie. It's one of those movies that, you know, we screened it at the Traverse City Film Festival to a jam-packed crowd. And this is Michael Moore's Film Festival, and we had two sold-out shows. And in both shows, we got standing ovations at the end. People were on their feet. You could hear people cheering and sighing and gasping during the football sequences because they were so invested in these kids. There was one point where the star wide receiver made a catch, a huge catch, and I was shooting on the sidelines, and I'd been there 10 days following these kids around, and I was so invested that I lost my marbles and started screaming and cheering and missed the shot. Thankfully, you know, we had six cameras going, so somebody got it.
Yeah, so that's really remarkable, that because I think, as I told you, I think it's true. This is a roughly a 90-minute film. I think about the last half an hour, so about a third of the movie really is about what happens on that day. In the movie, that you get this build up, this sense, okay, so this is really, it's a really big game. It's the big crosstown rival. Mm-hmm. There's a class sort of thing going on there, because sort of those are the rich kids, and these are very much blue collar kids. So there's that going on there.
Absolutely.
And so there's this big build up to the game, and you see that you're in the locker room there, and you see the coach, and you see how much it means to him, and you see how much it means to them. And so then you go out, and then they play the game. And we will not say who wins.
Right. And here's the thing. I mean, you know, they're a good team. There's no doubt about that. And you build on that early on in the film. We show you how good they were at that point. And so it makes it all that much more remarkable, considering the circumstances that they deal with. And, you know, as you mentioned, and I don't know if you caught this, but the coach's halftime speech was a metaphor for, you know, what Muslim Americans are going through and Arab Americans are going through in the United States today. And it was while I was listening to it, I was just thinking, my gosh, is he thinking in those broad terms? And he wasn't. But it just so happens. But, you know, if you go to the screening tonight, watch that sequence again and listen to what he says. And it's a metaphor. He was talking to Muslim Americans. He was talking to Arab Americans around the country, you know. And it was basically that, you know, nobody's going to defeat you except for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that you need to pull it together, because it's too late. You know, every time you do something wrong, you're going to be called out on it because of who you are. And that's just the fact. And you have to do everything better, cleaner, and stronger than anybody else just to avoid those bad penalty calls and all of those things. And that's a metaphor for, you know, the whole country, really.
So I really thought one of the things that really struck me in this particular part of the film was the difference between the coach before they went out for the first half and at halftime. Mm-hmm. And they had some, I don't know if they had bad breaks. In the first half of the game, they got a lot of penalties called on them, and it clearly they were pretty amped up, and maybe they were just making mistakes because of that. And you see the coach when he's sending the players out there, and he gives this fire and brimstone kind of speech about how I don't want you just to win.
Yeah.
I want you to completely crush.
Right, right.
You know, I want to see bodies in the field and all that kind of stuff. So the players are already pumped up. Mm-hmm. And they go out there, and I'm thinking, coach, I'm not sure that was the right thing to way to send him out.
Yeah.
He's very different at halftime. And I wonder if he's also thinking, man, maybe I didn't give them the right, maybe that wasn't the right thing
to
do.
And just a little bit of clarity, the coach that you're talking about was the offensive coordinator. He is the fire and brimstone coach. The head coach is more of a Zen-like character. He's more of a Yoda type. He's kind of a quiet type. And he has trouble getting fired up. There's kind of a funny moment in the film where he gives them a pregame speech the night before, and he's trying to get fired up, and it's very artificial.
He can't quite do it.
You know, he kicks a chair over to try and get them amped up.
And they laugh.
And they laugh
because that's not him.
That's not him, exactly. Yeah, he can't do that. He's more of the measured, quiet coach. And so he has this second guy in command who's famous for his speeches. He's famous for firing them up. And that's another interesting thing, is that speech, outside of the context of who they were, if that were going on in any other locker room around the country, we wouldn't be thinking about exactly what he was saying, because, you know, football speeches tend to be violent in nature. They tend to use terms that you use in war, drop a bomb, you know, destroy them, you know, crush them. I want to see bodies flying. But, you know, and there was a lot of discussion about leaving that in the film because of the idea that you seeing, you know, because the assistant, the offensive coordinator is Arab American, he's a Muslim. seeing him talk like that makes you conjures up ideas of crazy terrorist. And so there was thoughts that, oh boy, we can't show that. I mean, you know, he's going to get in a lot of trouble. But if you took it completely out of the context of him being an Arab American or a Muslim American, and it's another football coach in any other place, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We wouldn't be thinking about the actual words that he was using and how seriously they're going to be taken. But I thought that that was important. We all thought that was important to show. If you thought that, there's a reason for it, you know, and think about it in that context. Is that's what the discourse, that's where it's taken us. We have to be so careful about those things. But we automatically jump to those kinds of conclusions about them. And so it's a football speech, and they use tough terms. And it maybe overamped the kids, I think. And so it was up to the head coach to reel them back in. You know,
okay. Yeah, it's really very interesting, and I think that you can really connect with the feelings expressed in this, and I think I don't think you can. Well, I don't know, maybe somebody can. I would say I don't think that you can really watch it without quite being caught up in the emotion of it. I think that was definitely I'm sure that was definitely your intention.
Absolutely. I mean, it's football. It's a great vehicle for telling stories. It's the universal language of sport. And the hope was that, you know, people who have never encountered a Muslim American, never encountered an Arab American, who have preconceived ideas about who they are, you know, which if you, for example, went on the Gazette's website after they posted a little story about the screening, the first comment, you know, said basically, I have no interest in you know, seeing a film about people who want to kill me, you know, and you, those are the kinds of things that people are thinking because they've never encountered a real person. All they've encountered is the things they've seen on television, the things they've seen in the news. And so there's this misconception about who they are. And I think that was part of why I wanted to do the film was because, you know, while I was based in Islamabad, you know, for 3 years, we covered the war on terror. We covered the radical side of things. We covered, you know, the hunt for bin Laden, the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 architect. And I was, you know, gone for the first 3 years after 9/11 overseas. So I didn't see what was going on here in the United States. And after coming back and seeing a little bit about what was going on, it just seemed really interesting to explore these issues from the other side of the coin and to explore it from an informational aspect, you know your neighbors kind of thing. And the more I learned about this and the more I learned about the story and my wife and Rashid as well, we just said this story's got to be told.
Yeah, but I'm sure that also it seemed to make sense that you, as your theme and as your guiding metaphor, we had something that was such an American institution. So you could say that, well, you know, it's high school football.
Right.
We know what that is, and it's the, you know, it's Friday Night Lights, and
exactly.
It doesn't matter where it is you're talking
same.
About. It's
yeah.
it's the same thing.
And there was just one image in my head that really caught me, and it was. You know, I could see it in my head, and it was we went to a game, and we saw, you know, I thought about it from a camera view, basically zoomed in on a woman in the crowd, in a crowd surrounded by Arabs, and she had a headscarf on, and she was elderly, and she was pumping her fist. And you would imagine that the camera would pull out and turn over, and there'd be a burning American flag next to her. Well, no, she happened to be at a football game, a high school football game, cheering on her nephew. And it was so interesting to see that juxtaposition. You know, Friday night after the game, the players go to the coach's house and his mother cooks. She grills. And what does she grill? She has kebabs and hot dogs on the same grill. I mean, they literally meld everything together. And it's, you know, their faith and their culture and their you know, their all-American sort of team and it's all sort of mixed together, and it's really, really an interesting juxtaposition that I think sort of for some people might be off-putting, but it makes for very interesting filmmaking.
Mm. Again, I want to say for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'll have an opportunity to see this movie we've been talking about, Fordson, Faith Fasting Football, tonight at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign, 7 o'clock. It's free, so you should take it in. We'll talk some more with Ashar Qureshi about this movie and about some of his experiences making the movie, and we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
Journalist Craig Timberg says for years, international AIDS groups overlooked important factors in the spread of the HIV virus, like the effectiveness of circumcision.
The difference between the men who were circumcised and the men who weren't was 8-1 in terms of their infectiousness.
On the next Fresh Air, Timberg explores the history of the virus and efforts to fight the AIDS epidemic. His new book is Tinderbox. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by the Farmer City Antiques Merchants, presenting the 18th Annual Farmer City Antique Show on Saturday, March 3rd from 10 to 5 and Sunday, March 4th from 11 to 4 at the Blue Ridge High School in Farmer City. More information is at 217-356-3902.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here. We are here with the program weekday mornings 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Let me just mention that tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Matthew Allender. He's a wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist. He's also a visiting instructor in the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. And we will talk about wildlife health, ecosystem health, and how all that relates to human health. Then also tomorrow we will do a little Illinois history. We'll talk about what was going on in Illinois at the time of the War of 1812, and our guest will be Gillum Ferguson. He's an attorney and historian and is author of a new book that's titled Illinois in the War of 1812. You can check the schedule, find out what we'll do in the days ahead by going to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. You can follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. You can find us on Facebook. In this hour of the program, our guest is Ashar Qureshi. He is an Emmy Award-winning television journalist, writer, photographer, filmmaker, more than a decade of international investigative and long-form reporting experience. He currently is correspondent for WTTW, that is the public television station in Chicago, where he reports for their flagship nightly news magazine, Chicago Tonight. His reporting photography has been featured in another number of places, CNN, New York Times, PBS NewsHour, A&E. He was Pakistan bureau chief for CNN and is the co-producer of the film Fordson Faith Fasting Football, about a mostly Muslim football team in Dearborn, Michigan. And it will be shown at the Art Theater tonight at 7. It's free. He'll introduce the film, and we'll be there for some discussion afterwards. So stop by. He is also, I want to make sure you also mention, he is also a graduate of the University of Illinois. And maybe you might want to talk a little bit about a project that you'll be involved in. I know that Nancy Benson, who is a member of the journalism faculty, is doing this too, where you're going to be taking some students and you're going to be going to Turkey.
Right. We are taking a group of about 9 students with us as part of Nancy's international reporting class covering issues related to Islam. And so we'll be traveling to Turkey in May. And as part of that, that project where these students will be learning the basics of international reporting, and they'll also get firsthand experience of what it's like to report from a country they've never been to. They'll be covering some of these issues related to Islam as well. Turkey is a great place to explore those issues. Turkey's the crossroads of the East and the West. There's a lot going on there politically, and it's that one country that seems to straddle both the Western world and the Eastern world, and trying to find a balance between what's going on in the Middle East with the Arab Spring and being part of the EU. So there's a lot of interesting aspects to that particular location. We'll also be the pieces that we'll produce will air then on our station, WTTW, in Chicago, hopefully as part of a special. And, the experiences tonight, they're going to go see the film tonight, which is, it works out just well. A lot of issues related to, Islam and being a Muslim American are covered in the film. And they'll be learning a little bit about that as part of their course this semester. So it's just good timing, I think.
Yeah. Okay, great. We have a caller. We'd certainly invite other people into the conversation. If you're interested in joining us, you can call us at 333-9455. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Or you can send us an email, will-talk, at illinois.edu. That is the address. And we have somebody here on our line number one. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Hi. Well, this isn't going to be good, but I don't like football. I think it's an awful game. I think it's a great metaphor for the violence of America. I was just thinking back. I go back as far as remembering the Kennedys being lampooned for playing touch football or flag football or something that doesn't involve, making the bodies fly, as it were. And I just, so I wouldn't be able to get enthused about the film. I think it might be a great project to show the slice, but World football is fine with me. It's not like I don't like sports, but I really wish you were here talking about your experience in Pakistan. So I don't know whether the host will allow a question on that or whether you're.
Well, of course. You sure? Go ahead.
Well, I just wonder when you were there and what you feel about the coverage, because I have read a few books on Pakistan, Tariq Ali's The Duel and Descent into Chaos by Ahmed Rashid, and I just think the reporting is here stinks. And just for one instance, has there ever been really a good report about how many national security operators there are roaming around Pakistan, even though, you know, when one gets kidnapped or taken into prison like Davies was, there's just not a lot of follow-up about what's really going on the ground, it seems to me. And I think the shallow reporting is very dangerous, and I just think that we need more, as was illustrated just a few days ago, major scholars on Pakistan don't have it right. They were thinking that nobody in the U.S. was worried about the independence of Baluchistan, and the House of Representatives passed a sense of the Congress that they wanted to support the Baluchi freedom fighters, and it's just it's mad, and it's dangerous, and I just wanted you to comment on what you learned while you were at CNN, I guess, and how frustrating it might have been.
Sure, absolutely. I will agree with you to a certain extent that the coverage needs to be better than it is. And it's tough. It's a very tough post. When I went into Islamabad, it was at, you know, the beginning of the so-called war on terror. It was, you know, a country that was not prepared for the media blitz it was about to encounter. And there were a lot of issues that they didn't even know how to deal with. I mean, just getting satellite coverage out of there was like pulling teeth. It was impossible to get what was called a DNG license. People were just setting up things left and right, and the country was trying to deal with it. And, you know, at that time, you have to realize it was under military dictatorship. President Pervez Musharraf, General Musharraf, was still the law of the land. And, you know, it's one of those countries that's so difficult to report from because, you know, especially in the last 10 years or so, it's just hasn't been very safe for journalists. I think we lost more journalists last year who were killed in the line of fire than we had in the previous 20 years, something like that. And Pakistan was one of those first places where we saw journalists targeted for their reporting. Just months after I got there, Daniel Pearl, who was the Wall Street Journal reporter covering issues out of Karachi at the time, was there with his wife, Marianne Pearl. He was kidnapped while he was pursuing a story. And, you know, he eventually killed in Pakistan. And I think that that was a wake-up call for journalists in Pakistan, that there was no safety net. And part of what happened with Daniel Pearl, I think, was a cautionary tale to journalists and a warning to the government that, you know, foreign correspondents, doesn't matter who they are. If they're American, it doesn't matter. They can be targeted for their reporting. And it really put the fear in a lot of journalists, I think. And unfortunately, it makes journalists there think about things before they report them a little bit, because you have to balance between the safety of your sources, the safety of your colleagues, and the importance of the reporting. So I'll agree that it could be deeper, but I think that there are circumstances in Pakistan over the last 10 years that have sort of culminated in this lack of coverage. I mean, after we left, I mean, CNN had a lot of trouble replacing us, and we left for safety issues primarily. You know, the government also has a part to play in this. I think if they allocated the resources that they have in the Inner Services Intelligence Agency, the ISI, which is the CIA of Pakistan, I mean, they're so caught up with the media coverage. They literally, when we were there, our phones were tapped. We were constantly under surveillance. We were followed. We were shaken down. If they spent that much, I think, time and resources on keeping track of what's going on around the country, what's going on with the dissension in Balochistan, as you mentioned, with what's gone on in the Swat Valley, in the Northwest Frontier Province, in the tribal areas, if those resources were better allocated, instead of keeping track of what the headlines of the day were and what the international correspondents were doing and reporting in terms of the image of the country, it would be a safer place. And so, you know, the hope is that it'll open up to a certain extent. I mean, that was the hope when there was this so-called return to democracy with, Musharraf going out of power. But I can't say that the coverage has gotten better since he left. So, you know, it's a big question. And I know some news outlets are allocating more resources to the coverage of Pakistan. It's an incredibly important country in terms of our relationship and our presence in South Asia. And from a security standpoint, it's the front line. It continues to be the front line. I mean, bin Laden was captured inside the boundaries of Pakistan. The top al-Qaeda operatives, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, captured in Rawalpindi. So, you know, there it's that operating ground that and that sort of blurred line between Pakistan and Afghanistan that we've been dealing with for the last 10, 12 years needs a lot more attention. And I agree. I think if it were safer for journalists, we'd see a lot more coverage, a lot more in-depth reporting out of there.
About 10 minutes left in this part of the show with Ashar Qureshi. He is an Emmy Award-winning television journalist, writer, photographer, filmmaker, works for WTTW, which is the public television station in Chicago, and is the co-producer of this documentary film that we have talked about as well, Fordson Faith Fasting Football. And it'll be shown downtown Champaign at the Art Theater tonight at 7, and he'll be there. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at what point in your life did you decide you wanted to be a journalist?
When I got to organic chemistry.
You were going to be something else?
I was pre-med. I was pre-med, as all good South Asian kids are, I guess, initially. But, you know, I think I was a journalist in denial because throughout my life, I'd always written. I'd always loved writing. I'd loved production. I think I shot my first stop-motion animation film when I was 6 and picked up my first video camera when I was probably in my early teens and started shooting then. And I was a nerd on the audiovisual club, and I shot every game and every concert in high school, and I was the editor-in-chief of the paper. I just never thought of putting them together and making it a career. And I think my sophomore year here at the university, once I got to organic chemistry and I thought, well, what's the relevance of this to medicine? And I not being able to connect the dots, I thought, well, I could cover medical issues as a journalist and more. So, I applied, and Nancy, who I credit greatly for encouraging me to stick with it. I mean, I think very few of us, it's such a long weed out process. Very few of us, even from my class, stuck with it and stayed with it. I would guess 3 or 4 of us are still committing acts of journalism. It made sense based on what my interests were, what my skill set was, and so far so good, knock on wood.
Yeah. So I think certainly the kind of work that you did do when you were in Pakistan, I think that that's important. I mean, we really need people like that, but it's difficult, it's dangerous. If people have families, there's some real issues there. I'm sure that it's very, very hard. And as you say, we've lost we've lost some really fine reporters, and I think we just have to admire and applaud people who are willing to do that kind of work. Do you ever see
Absolutely.
Yourself doing that again?
Yeah, I think there's a possibility. I mean, you're right. We lost Marie Colvin recently in Syria, and you know, she was one of those war correspondents who literally she'd fall off the horse and she would just continue on. She would trudge on. And that's the kind of reporting, you know, that stalwart reporter. I've worked with photographers who are like that, who've been injured. A good friend of mine, Ben Wiedemann, who was the Cairo bureau chief for a long time, who was shot in the West Bank, you know, through his flak jacket, and he survived that, and he went back in to report. You know, you don't think about those things because the commitment is to telling the story. I mean, I remember a time when my wife and I, you know, she was producing with me, and so it made it easy for me because I had my partner with me right there, where we were in Karachi and we were flying out of the military base there out to the border with Iran to cover a $500 million heroin bust. And it was one of the largest in history. And we got on a military chopper to be escorted out there. And there was a group of journalists. And 15 minutes after takeoff, you know, the chopper starts rattling. And, you know, we didn't know that there was anything particularly wrong until we looked over at the general who was sitting in the seat ahead of us. And his knuckles were turning white from the grip he had on the chair. And we started going down. And we basically, you know, we were about to crash the helicopter. And we did a hard landing and the ground crew just rushed over to us and said, there's no way that the helicopter was built to land the way you just landed. So you were really lucky you weren't killed. And apparently a bird had hit the propeller in just the right way that it caused the entire system to just fail. And there were a lot of journalists on that chopper that were really shaken up. But my wife and I looked at each other and we said, well, how do we get out to the drug bust? And so an hour later, we jumped on a Cessna, flew out, and covered the story. And then it wasn't until that night when we got home that we thought, that was insane, you know. And it's adrenaline. And, you know, some journalists have the longevity or they have the adrenaline rush that gets them through it for, you know, days at a time, weeks at a time, months at a time. And then there are those who can do it for years on end. And there's not that many of those people. And that's the thing is you have to be prepared for a particular lifestyle. And if you're willing to, you know, deal with the family issues that you're going to eventually have if you're a foreign correspondent or a war correspondent who's away from home all the time, then you can pull it off. But for your average person, it takes superhuman strength, and that was part of why we left as well.
Yeah. So do you ever see yourself going back to that?
I actually do think – I think more in a documentary form. I think we're seriously – it's funny. I was thinking about this last night because we have several projects that we're considering right now, and at least two of them involve going back to Pakistan. And one of them is actually a story that I did for CNN that when I did it at the time, I thought this would make an amazing documentary. And so I think we're leaning towards going back to shoot a documentary in Pakistan at this point.
Okay. You want to talk about what it's about?
Maybe
would
a little.
You rather not?
Yeah. You know what? We'll come back and do that because I haven't told my wife yet. So we'll discuss it, and there's a couple ideas, and two of them would involve travel to Pakistan as well. So it's a very tough place to work out of. I know in the last couple of years there's been a lot of opening up of media and channels, and it's become almost as aggressive as the news media is in India, for example. But when I was there, it was state-run television. It was a startup cable news channel. And it was the international network, CNN, Al Jazeera, and BBC, and that was it. And it's gotten a lot more competitive now, I think, locally. But I think that internationally, there's been a squeeze out of journalists, unfortunately, because of the realities on the ground.
Yeah. Well, I would just earlier I said to you, I think that we really have to admire documentary makers for doing the work because it's hard to get the funding, so then you got to get your movie made, and then you got to get to the point where you can get it into a form where anybody can see it.
Right.
And the idea of having some theater show it is pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
It's not impossible, but it's pretty unlikely. Occasionally, documentaries really catch fire and they become viable commercially, but that's not always possible.
Right. We were very lucky. I mean, it just so happened that, you know, we were doing the festival route and, you know, I worked in Kansas City for 4 years and I had a lot of colleagues and friends who would come out to support. And it also happens to be the headquarters of AMC Theaters. And when I found out that AMC Theaters was partnering up with the Kansas City Film Festival, I said, you know, it's not considered one of the big film festivals, but I thought strategically this would make a great place for us to showcase what we've done. And so a colleague of mine from my station at the CBS station out there who was curating films for that festival approached me in Park City, Utah and said, hey, you know, would you guys want to show it in Kansas City? And at first we didn't think we were going to do it. And then I thought, you know, this makes a lot of sense. And so we promised that we would sell out the biggest theater that they had. And, you know, AMC's got a phenomenal, gorgeous, you know, sort of model theater in downtown Kansas City, not far from their headquarters. And so we played in the largest theater on the largest screen that they had. And we sold out. We sold more seats in that screening than any other screening had in the entire festival. And it just so happened that an executive from AMC Theaters happened to be in the screening and was just looking around thinking, wow. You know, this is amazing. And so I think that impression really got talks started with AMC Theaters to partner with us. And we were lucky enough to have, you know, a almost 20-city premiere at AMC. And so we played in all the major cities, New York, L.A., Chicago, Washington. And then, you know, for a documentary, that's just – it's unbelievable to have that kind of support and to do it without a middleman. You know, it was direct. There was no distributor. Wow. We distributed the film ourselves. And so I learned a lot in terms of distribution, and we worked in partnership with AMC Theaters to bring it to a lot of people. And then we did a couple of cities after that big release, And now we're doing the community screenings, which has given us an opportunity to come out here to Champaign.
Yeah. So have you recouped the cost of making the movie?
We have not. We have not. I mean, it was that was the thing. We basically said to ourselves that, you know, this is a passion project. And so we weren't going to spare expense because we knew it was coming out of our pocket. We said, this is a passion and this is a story we want to tell. And we know that this is not going to make us a lot of money or rich or maybe even make us poor, you know. But we felt that we needed to do it. We believed in the project. And so, you know, the hope is that eventually down the line we'll recoup the costs, you know. And at the very least, people are going to see this. Hopefully on a larger scale nationally, once we work within the broadcast rights that we're trying to get it distributed locally and domestically and then internationally as well, and then DVD sales and all those kinds of things. And maybe eventually down the line, 5 or 6 years, we might get to the point where we make a dollar.
Yeah.
So.
Well, again, I want to mention that for people who would like to see this movie that we have talked about here, Fortson Faith Fasting Football, it will be shown at the Art Theater downtown Champaign tonight, 7 o'clock. There's one showing. It's free. Ashar will be there to talk about the movie. And I think, I watched it on a DVD on my laptop, so it was pretty little. I think that it would have a great impact if you had the opportunity to see it on a big screen, particularly I know not everybody will get jazzed about watching high school football, but I think that those sections of the film are really pretty powerful. And I think that it actually is easy to get caught up in it. I thought it was also interesting too, early in the football, people talked about the fact that, well, in the Arab world, you know, what people do, they play soccer,
right?
What they call football. And that there was at one point a soccer team. That the first thing that they did at Fordson was they organized a soccer team. But it sounds like it wasn't very long before people said, no, what we want to play here is football.
Exactly. It was, you know, you thought, well, you know, oh, you're Arab and the national sports, it's soccer, it's football, that traditional form of football. And so they thought the soccer team was going to be, you know, the team to beat at Fordson. And it turned out that, well, they weren't really interested in soccer, and they weren't very good at it, actually. And so the really talented athletes, they went out and played football. And it became... you know, this phenomenon. And Fordson had a tradition. I mean, a little bit of history about Fordson. You know, it's the first million-dollar high school built in the United States. It's a gorgeous building. I mean, that also helped with the aesthetics of the film. Was it didn't hurt to have a gorgeous setting for this the story. And Fordson was originally built for the executives of Ford Motor Company.
It was Henry Ford built it.
Yeah, Henry Ford built it. He named it after his son, thus the name Ford Son. And, you know, he had a tractor called the Fordson Tractor, and that's where the teams take their mascot. Their mascot is a tractor, the Fordson Tractors. And it's also the sister school of the University of Michigan, and so they share the maize and blue colors as well. So the building also has similar architecture to what you would see on the campus in Ann Arbor, for example. And, you know, it was interesting because Fordson was always a good team, even in the 30s and the 40s, as the immigrant populations moved in and became more blue-collar, more working class. And eventually came to where it is now. And so, you know, I ran into an elderly gentleman at a gas station in Dearborn, or just outside of Dearborn, who said he used to play football at a rival school in the 50s. And he said that if you weren't the saying they had back then was, if you weren't playing against Fordson, you weren't playing football, because they had a long-standing tradition of being one of the toughest teams in the area.
Right.
And
well,
they wanted to carry that tradition on.
Tonight at 7 o'clock at the Art, or you want to find out more about the movie, you can go to the movie website, which is FordsonTheMovie.com. Our guest this morning, the co-producer of the film, Ashar Qureshi. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
And that's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.com. KansasCityMarkTweet.edu. In Kansas City, MarTweet turning at 681 and three quarters. That's up three quarters. May, 689 and a half, up one and a quarter. MarTweet Chicago, 643, up two. The May contract up six and a quarter at 647 and a half. March corn, 643 and a quarter, up two and a half. May, 646 and three quarters, up two and three quarters. July, 649, up two and a half. September, 588 and three quarters, up one half. March soybeans, 1290 and a quarter, up 11 and a quarter. May, 1298 and three quarters, up 12. July, 1306 and three quarters, up 11 and a half. August, $13 and three quarters cent. That is up 11 and a quarter. March soybean meal, 338.40, up 480. March oil, 54.41, up